It's Radio City. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you, talking a little bit about what's going on in the pop culture world this week. We've got all kinds of things to talk about as we look into the world of music. And of course, we've got some sad goodbyes to make note of this week. And we're going to talk about one of our favorite albums as well. And Rob Ross, good to talk to you, man. How's everything going?
It's going so far, John. How are you doing?
About the same. It's been one of those weeks. But, you know, we have so much to look forward to. And I want to start off with some of the new music we've got this week, because there's a bunch that we've been looking forward to, and now we have it in our hot little hands. And I want to start with the Feelies, because the Feelies is a band that you've been familiar with for a very long time. They're celebrating 40 years this year, and in the New York, New Jersey area, there are those bands that have become sort of locally famous, but when you're talking about a metro area that's got that many millions of people in it, locally famous is kind of a big deal. Take us through some of the history of the Feelies.
Let me just say this, going hand in hand with what you're talking about. They're not just locally famous. At this point, they could be considered, I would dare say, universally legendary.
Definitely.
Now, part of it is because, and this is just my opinion, people still are locked into their debut album, Crazy Rhythms, which was a different lineup. But the fact is, the Feelies have always been, no matter who was in the band, when you see them live, they have this kind of quirky, frenetic, just this insatiable energy on the stage that really transcends well. When I say this is a truly great live band, you can see them then, you could see them now, and you will always get that kind of feel, no pun intended, from them.
Right, and this album, the brand new one that's out from them in recognition of their 40th anniversary, is called In Between, which is kind of an odd name for an album that comes out 40 years after you start your career, but it has a lot of that same kind of energy and that same kind of energy build inside each one of the songs on this album. Tell me about what you heard when you were listening to it.
Well, the funny thing is you just hit it right on the head, that energy build, which is something I think is kind of a trademark in their songwriting style. The songs may start a little slow and a little quiet, and then it starts to mount until you get a full throttled oral assault, oral, A-U-R-A-L, oral. And there's it's a quiet power. That's the best way to describe it.
Yep.
And it works either way, with either electric guitars or acoustic guitars, but because they're so deft at that kind of wonderfully driving acoustic thrash. And I just want to say, when they do go with the two electric guitar attack, quote unquote, you always have one that's a little bit more subdued and cleaner sounding, almost without any kind of effect, lined straight into the board, versus the one guitar that's got some feel and distortion on it. So they play off of each other in a very crisp kind of orbit.
Right. So when you're comparing an album like this back 40 years ago to, as you said, a different lineup, a different stage of the career, where does this one fit in their palette?
And, you know, I look at the Feelies as being incredibly progressive. Go back to The Good Earth, which came out in 1986. And that was... it was a lot more textured. It was also their second album after a six-year gap. It was a band reaching further than what people may have expected,
yeah,
but ultimately was satisfying and reached an incredible audience. You move on to Only Life, and that's another progression there. Then you skip down to the last album that came out 6 years ago, believe it or not, Here Before, which it's kind of another ironic title, because you think Here Before and you're thinking maybe, okay, well, this is a familiar sound, a familiar territory that we might be on. But it's not. It's, again, going forward. And here, with In Between, they do the same. They use the patented, and forgive me for using that word, Feelies sound, but it works. It works because they still can stretch their own boundaries.
Another time.
This one up. It's called In Between. It It's out from the Feelies, and we're just doing a little talking about new music in this segment of the show. So let's get to a band that, I mean, you laid this one on me a little bit earlier this week, and I couldn't have been happier with it, because I love a good foot stomper, and I don't think there's any better way to describe the one that's out now from a band called Scotch Hollow. Who are they?
This young band from Kansas City. This was one of those happy finds that was submitted to me, and I gave it a listen, and I thought, my God, there's so much energy here, so much feel, so much soul, so much twang, you know, like you said, a good stomp.
Yeah.
There's a good stomp. There's a good bit of, you know, that kind of Western swing to it. I mean, it's just an album filled with good nature, good feelings. Everything about it is so positive and uplifting. And, you know, if you're in a blue mood, this is the kind of thing that will give you that desperately desired uplift.
Yeah, you know what I really love is when a band like this is able to go back to the pieces of what made rock and roll. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this when we get into the Sun Records TV show that just debuted this past weekend in a little bit. But when you can distill it down and you can hear the echoes of the country swing like you were talking about, and the gospel and the R&B that all melded into rock and roll, all these years later, when a band really gets that and builds it up again, that's an exciting thing to listen to.
And it also doesn't sound forced or
right,
or,
right.
It's natural. That's what I'm trying to say. It's just a natural. You could tell these people love this kind of music. They've studied it. It's part of them. So they're able to execute it and convey that feel.
Excellent. And again, it's a brand new album out from them. The band is called Scotch Hollow, and there's more information, of course, elsewhere on popdose.com. And Rob Ross and John Grayson here with you, talking it over on this Radio City podcast of ours. Matthew Walcott also had a debut album that appeared on Popdose. The review did, anyway. So tell us a little bit about what we've got out from Matthew Walcott.
Well, this Dallas-based singer has delivered an EP, which is possibly one of the best EPs I've heard since... Because now here comes the nostalgia moment. EPs were a big commodity that happened in the early 80s when you were trying to break somebody new. And my two favorite EPs of that era were, of course, the first one from Flag of Convenience. If anybody knows who that is, well, I give you infinite amount of credit. That was Steve Diggle and John Marr of the Buzzcocks with their post-Buzzcocks project. They put out an EP in 1982, and, of course, Chronic Town.
Yes.
And I don't think I've heard an EP with this kind of sheer delight to it since. And Matthew Walcott has this, he's a wonderful pop writer with that mixture of Americana and countrified vibe. But his lyrics are incredibly visual for a start. His voice is very welcoming and soothing. And the most, I guess, salient thing for me is that when I listen to his voice, he reminds me a lot of one of our favorite singers, Peter Holsapple.
Yep.
There's something in his delivery, his intonation, his everything vocally. The Grand Terrain will not let my spirit sway, and this mighty engine is screaming home. It's almost as if he's channeling Mr. Holsapple, and I give him full marks for it. If he knows who Peter is and is influenced by him, I tip my hat even more. If he doesn't, then he's doing a remarkably unconscious job.
Right, right. And as we always tell you, every time we talk about new music, there's always information there on the page in addition to just the words in the review. You also get a sampling of the music, sometimes some video there for you on the page. So kick around here on popdose.com and look at some of the other articles that you'll find, and you're always going to find a little bit of something extra in there. So definitely want to check out Matthew Walcott, the new Feelies album, Scotch Hollow. And as we get into television, you and I had talked about this over the email a couple of days ago, have been looking forward to, with a little bit of trepidation, honestly, the debut of the new TV series Sun Records, which goes back to the days when Elvis and Johnny Cash and that entire crowd was getting together to make what eventually became the Memphis Sound. We've seen the debut episode. What'd you think?
Well, it was entertaining enough. I will say that much. And I don't think that's any kind of scathing indictment of it. It was, you know, it's meant to be an entertainment. To see shots of Memphis, of course, I'm watching it strictly for that, just on that you know, pretext alone.
Yes.
You know, the story of Sam Phillips, which I think was put to great depth in the books that have been written about him. I think there's plenty more accuracy to be found there. But again, let's remove ourselves from being musical historians or nitpickers. Okay, let's just look at the TV show.
Yeah.
It's entertaining by virtue of the fact that you've got a very good cast. The fellow who's playing Sam Phillips, I believe it's Chad Michael Murray is his name.
Yep.
He bears a striking resemblance to the young Sam Phillips. You know, here's the simple facts. Sam Phillips founded Sun Records as a way of putting out records that he wanted to hear. He loved R&B. He loved, quote, race music,
yep,
which, of course, at the time was completely verboten, especially in the South. He wasn't making any money. The reason why he wound up having an amount of success was because he signed somebody like Elvis Presley, who, in his own words, you know, if I could find a white boy who sang like a black boy, I'd make $1 million.
And he did, yeah.
And he did. I mean, Elvis had that natural, gifted feel. You know, Elvis wasn't yet managed by Tom Parker, so Elvis was completely free and unencumbered.
Yeah.
And when you listen to those earliest Sun Records, Elvis never reached that kind of apex of energy or just great material again. There were some good things that he did over the years, but nothing will ever equate, certainly, Baby Let's Playhouse and Mystery Train or Blue Moon of Kentucky.
Right.
Now, having said that, and here's where I'm going to start to roll, so just be careful. you know, it wasn't just Elvis Presley. He had Johnny Cash's earliest things. He had Carl Perkins. He had Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yep.
He had Roy Orbison. I mean, you're talking about a stable of stars like no one could even imagine. Unfortunately, the cost of putting out the records that he wanted to hear was what cost him their contracts, because they all wound up leaving him sooner than later. Nevertheless, the TV show itself, it has its inaccuracies. All TV shows are going to, especially historically based programs.
Yeah.
They're always going to have to take a liberty and use a little artistic and creative license. So let's keep going and see how either much better it may get or if it gets worse. Look, we've already weathered the worst of all storms. We sat through vinyl.
When
you sat through vinyl, nothing is ever going to be as bad.
Right. That's the thing about this is you can give it a lot of room there. You can also give it a lot of room based on the fact that this TV show is based on the stage play. So you're talking about not only being one step removed, but two steps removed from the actual history of it. So as an entertaining romp through what life may have been a little bit like, it's fine. And the other thing is, and I say this not to drop a name, but just to point out the fact that Billy Gardell and I have been friends for a while, and to see his portrayal of Colonel Tom Parker has been, even just through that first episode, it was a lot of fun seeing him interpret that character. I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes.
And it's also nice to actually see him in a dare I say, much more serious role.
Yes.
You know, this is straight acting. This isn't sitcom.
Right.
You know, or doing his stand-up routines.
Yep.
So, yeah, full marks to him for showing that he does indeed have the acting chops and abilities. Look, the best thing that can happen is that this could draw in a new audience, a younger audience if possible, to the music of Sun Records, because it's our history.
Right.
This is where it all began for all of us, because without Sun Records, none of us would be here.
Yeah, and it also, I think it was nice that they very lovingly put together that set. I mean, anybody who's ever walked in the doors at Sun, as soon as they walked in the doors on the show, you got the goosebumps, you know, the hair on your arm started to stand up and you went, wow, that's it. They did it. And it all looks right. So for the rest of it, you know, for the acting and everything else, it all looks right. And that's what I wanted first.
You know, look, you know how I get about Memphis. I get very weepy. I get very emotional about it. And of course, my heart is there. You know, for a born, raised, and still New Yorker, my heart is in Memphis.
Yep.
So what more can I say than that would make any sense?
Yeah, it was very, very nice to see again. So check it out. It's not going to be the best thing you've ever seen in the world, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And if you haven't yet, you catch the debut episode. What it will do is the one thing that debut episodes are supposed to do, which is leave you waiting for episode 2. So check it out. And again, Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, talking over the latest in pop culture. We've got a few more things to go over. And of course, we always encourage you to kick around elsewhere on popdose.com and find out what some of the other writers have for you. And DW Dunphy, who has been instrumental in getting us here, has also put together a column this week on crowdfunding. And I have to admit, I've seen some interesting crowdfunding campaigns. I've been a donor to a couple of them, but not many, because like everybody, I try to be as careful as I can with my money. So what does DW bring to the table when he's talking to the people who are putting these campaigns together?
Well, he brings a lot, and this is a very important piece that he's written. It's a very serious look at the whole crowdfunding phenomenon. And of course, you know, it could go in a much broader direction, because people tend to use GoFundMe now, it seems, for everything. But, you know, he kept it within the parameters of artistic crowdfunding. Like you, I have contributed to certain things. I have been, I would say, 75% satisfied with the things that I've contributed to. I mean, certainly the Big Star movie was a 100% win on every level.
Right.
And I couldn't be more pleased and proud to have been able to contribute to it. There were two musical campaigns that a friend of ours did, and I will leave our friend's name out, that by no fault of his, things did go sideways during the campaign. The first one was by virtue of the label that was supposed to be handling this release, that was going to go through Pledge Music, and there was supposed to be a box set which we all contributed to, and you know, you were supposed to get all this wonderful stuff with the box set of the release, etc. Long story short, the box set never happened. Now, the upside is full refunds were issued, so there was really no problem.
Yep.
His last campaign, my one, if you will, question mark, is that, you know, the funds went in 2014. The product wasn't finished and available until very late 2016. So, you know, considering there were all these, you know, perks, et cetera, that were going to go with it. Now, having said this, A, he is a friend. B, he certainly delivers on every single promise that he makes, and anything that you contributed to, he makes good on.
Mm-hmm.
And he did all of that. But the length of time was the only kind of head-scratching element. I guess it was that it turned out to be far more costly than he had even anticipated to make this project become a reality.
Well, that's now, yeah, one of the things that DW points out in the article, and I think it's the most important point, is that even if something does take longer than you thought it was going to take, update everyone constantly. Keep in contact, because these people gave you their money with that promise involved of something to come at the end of it. So you have to update everybody all the time, even if it's a little thing. Say, hey, we're still here. We're still cranking. Don't worry. Everything is still on track. Because if you don't do that, people are going to assume that you just took their money and ran off with it.
Completely right. And that's exactly what I was about to say. The great thing is that this friend of yours and mine, he did indeed do that. He's very good about it. It was just the length of time. But yes, I found that one of the most important things that DW brought up was the notion of you know, making sure that if you're going to get yourself in this situation as a performer, you have to know your own limitations. What can you handle in all of this? You know, are you going to be overwhelmed? Are you going to run out of time? is the funding going to be enough? Are you under budgeting, you know, in order to make those goals that you're going to set out there for people to hopefully want to contribute, you know? And you do have to ask yourself a lot of questions, you know. Do people really want your product? Are you going to be able to deliver on what you say you're going to deliver on in that desire? If there's enough interest, then you should be able to weather every single storm. Now, there are certain things that are, of course, going to happen that may be no fault of your own. And again, we're speaking strictly in musical terms. So sometimes plants get backed up, so you won't have the physical product when you think you're going to, you know? Costs may change. You know, there are an infinite number of things that can go awry that are out of your hands. But as you said, the most salient thing any one responsible person can do with a crowdfunded campaign of any kind is to constantly update the people that have funded you.
Indeed. And if I could add one thing to what DW put on the page, and again, the article is crowdfunding without losing friends or customers, both important things, is that you have to be very careful about where you house your funding campaign, because sometimes, and do your homework on this before you even start, the crowdfunding sources, whether it's Kickstarter, Indiegogo, GoFundMe, whoever it is, they gain and lose favor with audiences too. So you want to make sure that your crowdfunding is in exactly the right place and you found the right home for it. So it's a terrific article. It's a great primer. And if you've been thinking about getting yourself started in business, it's a great way to do it. So check out what D.W. Dunphy's got for you on the page. John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you and talking over a little bit. You know, we mentioned at the very beginning that one of our favorite albums came up a couple of times in conversation this week, and there's no specific anniversary of this, I don't think, although it's got to be close to 50 years old by this point, if not just a little bit beyond that. But there is an album from the mid to late 1960s that, because it has that Monkees label slapped on it, unfortunately doesn't tend to get the same kind of reverence that a lot of albums from that era do. And I just want to sort of wind you up and let you go on this. When somebody mentions Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones Limited to you, what's the first thought strikes your mind?
The Revolver.
Yes, yes, very much so.
That's my most oft-used answer whenever I have this conversation. And I have to tell you, I've had this conversation starting, I want to say at this point, 3-4 years ago. I remember having this conversation with that wonderful, incredible singer, Nick Celeste, and the equally wonderful and very kind radio personality, Chris Carter. We were talking about this on Facebook, and, you know, both of them actually, in a lot of ways, find this album to be more satisfying than Revolver, and I can understand it. I mean, there's a seamlessness of this record. To give you some absolute definitive points, if you will, it will be November that this album will be 50 years old.
Okay.
But this is the perfect, and I'm speaking strictly in terms of anybody and everybody who knows the story, history, lineage of the Monkees and, you know, the struggles they went through in controlling their own music. This was the perfect melding of them either being self-contained as a band in the studio or working with other musicians to get the sound that they wanted, where they played on some of the songs, but they also had help. And they also were able to pick from the pool of incredible songwriters that were always contributing to the Screen Gems catalog, of which the Monkees could always pluck from. Now, the most important thing about this album to me is, one, it has my all-time favorite Monkees song on it, Love Is Only Sleeping, which in fact was supposed to be a single. Now, it was not written by Michael Nesmith. It was written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, but he sings lead vocals on it. It was supposed to be the single. The powers that be at Cold Gems and RCA said that this is a little risque. So it was relegated to an album track, and the B-side was turned into the A-side, and the B-side was going to be Daydream Believer. The track that was used on the B-side in the end was taken off of the album, Going Down. So Love Is Only Sleeping is possibly the greatest Monkees single that never was. Having said that, it's my favorite song of the Monkees of all time. It's one of my top five songs of all time. It's a song that will always reduce me to tears and chills. It's a very powerful song to me. It is Michael Nesmith's voice, which reaches a height that can't be accurately described until you listen to it. She looked at me, and the emptiness in her eyes was cruel to see. Then she turned away and said, once I loved, but love is dead.
And I whispered, sometimes love is only sleeping.
And in headphones especially, because you really get the power and range. And it is from there that I was able to become a better singer.
Yeah.
Because I have tried so hard in my life, and I'm 52 now, to sound exactly like Nesmith did on that track, and I think I've got it.
Well, it only took that long. Only took you 30 years longer than it took him. But yeah, and I know exactly what you're saying. And the thing is, Nez's vocals across this entire album, and I mean, he didn't obviously sing everything on it, but he showed off so many different styles, because if you play Love Is Only Sleeping and then play Don't Call On Me behind that and then Door Into Summer, you hear three very different kinds of delivery from Mike Nesmith on those three songs. And
exactly.
I mean, to the point where it almost doesn't sound like the same guy.
It's also the fact that this is very much a Michael Nesmith directed album.
Yep. Right.
Salesman. Okay. Which he didn't write, but he sings. The Door Into Summer, which was written by Bill Martin
and Chip Douglas.
And Nesmith sings it. Love Is Only Sleeping. He wrote Daily Nightly, but Mickey sings it. He wrote Don't Call On Me and sings it. Don't Call On Me was described by Mr. Celeste as being possibly the greatest fuck you song ever written. And in the most subtle manner possible, if you really listen in depth to the words, the argument can be made and possibly won.
Right.
And Mike sings, of course, What Am I Doing Hanging Around, which, you know, it kind of finds him in his most natural wheelhouse, the most countrified of all songs.
Mm-hmm.
This is very much a Mike record. Oh, and by the way, Mike's very prevalent harmony / lead with Mickey on Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Right. And the, you know, the Davy Jones songs, the poppier tunes that are on here. You mentioned She Hangs Out a little while ago. Harry Nilsson's Cuddly Toy, which is just a gorgeous piece of music. And of course, Star Collector, the final song on the album. And in that one, as a kid, it's funny, that came up in conversation on Facebook this week. And as a kid, I thought that meant, you know, like an autograph hound. I had no idea what that song was about. But I said at the time, you know, if I had known then, I probably would have practiced harder.
Well, you know, here's the funny thing about that song. It came really not too long on the heels after Ruby Tuesday.
Right.
But this was definitely, because Ruby Tuesday is kind of considered to be the first song about groupies. But this song is just basically a starfucker song.
Exactly.
And you know, call it what it is, it's still an absolutely tour de force by Davey. I mean, he just sings balls out, because let's face it, Davey of the four of them didn't rock as hard, and it's not a knock on him. He just had the more theatrical voice, or the voice that was better suited to some of the ballads.
Yeah.
But, you know, here, Davey shows off some skills and some balls, and the same can be said for She Hangs Out. Now, hard to believe, that's Davey being, you know, a little on the schmaltzy side. But you know what? It still works.
Right.
And at the same time, you've still got Mickey, who always has that golden voice. It's a lot more restrained here, not the voice, but his performances, because all he gets on this album are words, Pleasant Valley Sunday, and Daily Nightly. But those three performances are performances for the ages.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, the things that they throw in, the interstices, you know, you can hear a little bit of the studio noise and things like that. And as contrived or not as that may have been, it, again, it just adds a lot of terrific atmosphere to the album. And I'm with you. I mean, this is when the monkeys grew up. Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones Limited. So if you haven't in a while, before it turns 50, get yourself a copy. There's been a bunch of reissues, too, with expanded studio tracks and other things, other little bits of material. But, I mean, just the pure vinyl album on this one, what you got when you went to the store in 1967 is plenty.
You know, the thing is, this is one of those albums that you don't really need bonus tracks,
right,
believe it or not, because this is so good and so flawless that I think bonus tracks would actually distract from it.
Yep.
You know, it's funny, because we've had the box sets of basically all the albums except for, and I'm talking about the larger square boxes, of all the albums except for Headquarters and Pisces Aquarius.
Yeah, so definitely. I mean, this is the time to do it. This is the time when it's needed the most. So go do that thing. And Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you. We've got a couple more things to talk about before we get to this week's rundown of sad goodbyes. You had the opportunity to do what so few people seem to have, because nobody can get tickets. You saw Hamilton.
I did indeed. I will be really honest with you. You know, I liked it a great deal. I really did. I enjoyed it. I thought the performances were dynamic, exciting. It was so different than anything I'd ever experienced in the theater. But I think a little of the edge or the excitement behind it was lost simply because it, at this point, is not the original cast that made it so much of the phenomenon that it very quickly became.
Yeah.
At the same time, I love the fact that it told a very clear story that is all fact-based, that it's all rooted in history. And as a kid, as a child, especially growing up during the bicentennial, I was so into the whole American Revolutionary period. I loved Revolutionary War history. You know, I thrived on knowing everything I could about the Continental Army from the moment that the Boston Massacre occurred all the way through to the surrender at Yorktown. So to me, this was a fantastic carry-on and, you know, the true foundation of our nation, especially at this particular time when things are just in such a state of upheaval and uncertainty. Yeah. and history, in fact, is being done away with. So I give it full marks for what it does and needs to do. And the fact that it's gotten so many kids interested in history, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But from the theatrical point of view, you know, I know it's probably comparing, you know, donuts to bananas, but I would probably rather see a revival of 1776, as I've done, because that's more my bag.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And it is, I guess, the one thing that a history book fails at, by nature, and it's by design, is that it has the facts and figures, and it tells you what happened, and there's no emotion to it at all. But what that loses is the fact that the men who were responsible, men and women who were responsible for making those things happen, were creatures of emotion as we all are. And that's where taking something like this and dramatizing it can bring a little bit of that life back into it. And you go, oh, now it makes sense why he did that. He was pissed. You know, it just,
right,
it fleshes it out. You go, oh, I get it. All right.
Right.
Yeah, he was a vindictive little asshole. And so he, you know, he pulled that stunt.
Right. Let us not confuse the founding fathers' heroism in the birth of this nation with the fact that they were very flawed, very foible-filled, fucked-up human beings.
Exactly.
I mean, Alexander Hamilton had a chip on his shoulder. He was an incessant womanizer. You know, he was an asshole.
Right.
He was a smart asshole, and that's the most important thing. What politician isn't?
Yeah, exactly. That's how they get to that position in the first place, as we've seen over these last few months. So, hey, interesting. You know, I've not seen it yet. I've heard a couple of the songs, as everybody has. You can't not. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the whole thing play out in front of me one of these days. So as soon as the touring companies arrive, that's when we're going to start checking out Hamilton across the country, which shouldn't be too long, by the way. So keep your eyes open for that. And a couple of more things to talk about here on Radio City. We've got a few sad goodbyes to mention, and none over the last couple of weeks was sadder than that, the loss of Al Jarreau. I mean, when you look at the career of this man over, again, 45, 50 years, maybe plus a little bit, the amount of music and the amount of transitions that he went through his own career, what an incredible talent gone. What comes to mind when you think back about Al Jarreau?
Well, first of all, the first thought that comes to mind is when I first heard Spain, when I was about 15. And, you know, when you and again, you have to take this in the context of who I was at the time. And I was this very myopic, punk rock oriented teenager.
Same here.
I heard Spain on, I think it was, believe it or not, the old WNEW-FM, because they had a wonderful tendency to play not your standard rock or pop all of the time. It might have been on Vince Scales' show. But I heard it on the radio, and I was just so mesmerized by the dynamics of his voice, which I took upon as an instrument, because it was nothing like I'd ever heard before. And I actually went out and bought a copy of This Time, the album that it came from. Lo and behold, maybe a few months later, there he was on the old ABC show Fridays. Remember Fridays?
Definitely, yes. With the Ganja Chef and all that, that was a great show.
Exactly. The Ganja Chef and that creepy little kid who would always play with soldiers and set them on fire.
And Michael Richards.
Yeah, Michael Richards. Michael Richards playing a character named Dick, who basically became Kramer.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so you get to see the building blocks of a lot of that stuff. Yeah, that was...
Right.
And to see somebody like Al Jarreau show up on that. Again, he was a much bigger star than that show had at the time.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that the show started to have its breakout stars, and maybe we can talk about it on another episode. But you know, the musical guests on that show were always so far ahead of the curve than, say, Saturday Night Live was at that point. I mean, you had Al Jarreau one week, you had The Jam live the next. Every band was on live.
Yep.
You had Devo, you had Cheap Trick, you had Split Enz, you had The Pretenders, you had The Clash make their television debut. Just an infinite array of wonderful performers, and there was Al Jarreau, and there he was doing Spain, and I just could not have been more thrilled watching that.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, to see him again go through the late 70s, go through the disco era, go through a little bit of the sort of return to the soul of soul in the early 1980s and come out with these incredible love songs. I mean, he was always that guy. There was never not an Al Jarreau hit around.
Correct. And I'm sure most people will know and or remember him for him being the singer of the theme song to Moonlighting.
Yep.
Which, okay, it wasn't one of my favorite shows, but hey, it was his voice, and that was more than good enough. And I found it really surprising, and of course shockingly sad, when, you know, just a few days before he passed, there was that news about him abruptly canceling his current tour.
Yeah.
And saying he was retiring permanently from exhaustion. So obviously something was very wrong, and it's just another tragic loss.
And unfortunately, this week has been full of them. We also lost the guy at age 73, who was known as the godfather of fusion. Larry Coryell died, and If you've never heard of him, I can't urge you strongly enough to go out and look at some of the video that's out there, listen to the entire body of his music, because here's a guy. What always struck me about Larry Coryell is he could take the simplest riff, the simplest jazz riff, start a song off with it, and then all of a sudden, 30 seconds in, it's on fire. I mean, it just goes from, you know, hey, this is a nice, cool little groove, to, oh my God, what am I listening to? It's incredible.
Word always came up with Larry Coryell, fluidity.
Yes.
His fingers, there's only one other guitarist that I can think of who did what Larry Coryell did, who is still going and can do the same thing, and that would be John McLaughlin. But Larry Coryell was one of those in a bracket by himself.
Yeah. And always had those big single-cut Les Paul-looking hollow bodies, and just beautiful guitars, and the sound that he got out of them. You're right. I mean, it seemed like there was no better home for him than on a fretboard. Some people can just look at it and get it, and Larry Coryell was that guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another very—I mean, one loss is not greater than the other. They're just all very sad.
Right. And a couple more to mention. Clyde Stubblefield. And here's, again, you talk about great roots. I mean, James Brown had one of the best eyes for talent ever. And for him to pick out Clyde Stubblefield early on, again, you look back at what that means now and you think, okay, yeah, he saw something there for sure. Talk about what else he did.
You know, let's stick with just the way that Clyde played drums. He was again, I'm going to draw a comparison with another incredible drummer that we lost 41 years ago, Al Jackson.
Yeah.
Of Booker T and the MGs and of Stax Records. The two of them, I think, are two of the greatest drummers that ever hit the skins. Clyde Stubblefield was like the and I want to use this term the right way, the ticking time bomb of soul and what became funk, because that man was a human metronome. He could play with his eyes closed, his legs taped together, and he still could make that time just start and stop. He knew how, when, where to play and not to play. And let's face it, when you played for James Brown,
right,
you were playing for baddest motherfucker that ever lived.
Yeah.
And the man, for all his faults, he had the ear, he had the timing, he had the knowledge, and Clyde Stubblefield was always there and on it. You listen to any James Brown record that Clyde's playing on, and that feel, that funky vibe, that powerhouse playing is there, and it's very much breathing and carrying the pulse of everything else. Whether it's the bass of the horn sections, it's always quiet as the metronome.
Right, and we move on from there again into the world of funk and soul. Junie Morrison, the guy who for a long time was the band director for P-Funk, and again, you talk about having your chops, you better have it down if you're going to keep control of an orchestra like that, and he did it. Was a musician in his own right as well, but was also as a producer and a band director, a guy who is the stuff of legend.
Right, and don't forget the work that he did with the Ohio Players. So you go from one unit that was pretty strident and powerful in their moment to move on to one of the greatest, if not the greatest, soul and funk tank divisions that has ever lived and breathed as a single unit, as the P-Funk All-Stars. Let's just call them what they're now known as, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that is a machine that has run now for 50 plus years. And he was a major, major contributor to keeping that fang running smoothly, just oiled all the time.
Right. And again, when you're talking about somebody that on stage has that kind of, you know, a band that has that kind of tightness when there's so many members and so much to keep track of, what an incredible job to keep something like that up and keep it going day by day and month by month while you're out on the road. So hats off to Junie Morrison for that reason, if for no other. And one more to mention, the one that came to us out of the world of acting just over the last little while is Bill Paxton's stunning death at age 61. Complications from surgery is what we're being told now. And, you know, again, a guy who was always entertaining to watch. He had that character actor label hung on him that, you know, he's a guy who you could just kind of put into any situation, whether it was Aliens or Twister or Big Love, and it didn't matter. He just felt comfortable, and you got that he was so into the characters that he played, and they were always fun.
Well, did you ever see the movie Frailty?
Yes.
Because that, I thought, was Bill Paxton at his absolute best. Of course, I'm going to get really personal and just remember him in the video for Fish Heads,
right.
Barnes and Barnes, because that's where, you know,
yeah.
I first recognized him from. So it shows that he had that really wonderfully goofy side about him, too.
Right.
But he was such a terrific actor. He was always somebody that you could not help but watch every moment of his performance. Big Love got really tedious at points and a little too goofy for its own good, but because he was so good at being that character, you know, it made it worth sitting through the 60 minutes you weren't going to get back. I mean, you know, he had a fantastic cast around him, you know, whether it was Jeannie Triplehorn or Jennifer Goodwin or Chloe Sevigny, it was still Bill Paxton's vehicle.
Right. Well, and let's talk about Twister here for a second, too. I mean, that's a terrible movie. But there are two reasons to watch Twister. You can watch Helen Hunt dirty, you know, and all mussed up, and that's kind of fun. And you can watch Bill Paxton be Bill Paxton. It's just, without the two of them, that movie doesn't work at all. It's just ridiculous.
Well, the whole Storm Chaser thing is just an insane concept to me to begin with. But, you know, I'm going to take a liberty because I need to have a reason to smile for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Helen Hunt was a crush of mine from the time we were both 12.
Quarterback princess. Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, I think I fell in love with her when she was on, I think it was this awful show called Swiss Family Robinson.
Yes, that's right.
If I remember correctly. And then she was on this terrible sitcom, and this is when I really fell madly in love with her, a terrible sitcom with Richard Crenna and Patty Duke and Anthony Edwards as her older brother, a show called It Takes Two. But that was when I fell completely in love with Helen Hunt. And
man.
Never was able to. That's why I watched Mad at You or whatever.
Mad
it was
About
called
You, yeah, right.
Yeah. I'm mad at you because that's all it's ever seen they were, was mad at each other. What a piece of shit show that was. But boy, she was just the everything.
Uh-huh.
So seeing her on the big screen getting all covered in mud and wind, that was fine.
Yeah.
But let's get back to the topic at hand. Bill Paxton, he took a piece of shit movie and made it watchable.
Right.
That's the short version of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, for people who really don't know his body of work, go back and revisit Big Love and go and check out the movie Frailty. It's a frighteningly disturbing yet powerfully engaging movie. You're going to sit there riveted to it.
Excellent. So, again, more homework to do. And just keep kicking around. Popdose.com. You can find everything you want about everything happening from books and movies and television. You know, I mean, just look at the top of the page right now and you'll see it all there splayed out for you. But this is the kind of talent that goes into writing and putting these articles together. So do that. And, Rob, as we look forward to our next edition of Radio City, what do we got coming up?
Just off the top of my head, there are two interviews that I just did recently that are up. One will be up tomorrow. One is up now. The one that's up now is with that wonderful singer who I introduced you to a few months ago, Lisa Saeed.
Yes.
Who is an incredibly kind and very patient human being because she gave me just the best, her best thoughts in a wonderfully interesting and intricate interview. We also have an interview with Stan Dembski from the Feelies, who is their thunder drummer and just a very kind and actually funny man who I like a great deal. A lot of other really good things are up and about right now. We have a new album by a young lady named Kate Grom, which is just out of sight, and I mean really out of sight. And just other things to look forward to and talk about, especially from my incredible colleagues at our incredible colleagues at Pop Dose.
Yes, and of course, as things continue to happen, we'll continue to talk about them here on Radio City. So, Rob, always a pleasure, my friend. And if I may, a little plug for the other stuff that I do during the week. It's not too long now. On the 13th of March, I'll be making my big debut on the Big 550 KTRS in St. Louis, Missouri. So if you happen to be in the area or you want to listen in online, every day from 10 a.m. to noon Central Time, we'll be there. And, of course, here with you each week on Radio City. And, Rob, thanks again, man. We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
You better believe it. God willing, all goes well. I will talk to you at the same time, brother.
You got to take care. There's more to come. John Grayson here with you and alongside Rob Ross from PopDose.com on Radio City.